So welcome, everybody, to the Occupy Chicago's teach-in series. We have so many awesome teach-ins, study groups, things like that planned. This is one in the series of many. We've had many going before. We'll have many coming after this. So this is co-sponsored by the Gender Equity Committee of Occupy Chicago, as well as the Education Committee of Occupy Chicago. So my name's Britt Schulte.
I'm Erica Frischioni.
And we'll be facilitating the meeting. We're going to speak for about 25 minutes, and then we'll have like a little over an hour for discussion and debate and dissent and, you know, get all those ideas going. So the title of the talk is You Can't Make Half a Revolution, Why Women's Liberation is Central to Occupy. And also, I might be kind of grabbing somebody out of the audience to help take stack, because nobody on the education committee could could come and help moderate discussion. So I see a lot of familiar faces that we'll be able to draw on to help us out. Awesome. Thanks so much. I'll be calling you out later. Great. So without further ado, go ahead and get started. So we're here today to discuss the goals, ambitions, and obstacles of the Occupy movement from the perspective of the politics of women's liberation. We aim to demonstrate that these politics are essential in building an effective and representative movement of economic and social equality. The main sections of our talk will take up the origin of women's oppression, the economics of oppression, violence, and fight back. Now, before outlining the roots of women's oppression, we need to define oppression and explain how it manifests itself. Oppression holds the key to exploitation as being an exercise in fostering divisions in a cruel and burdensome way. It not only fosters these divisions, but it also impedes our comprehension of what is being done to us. Oppressions are ways in which the 1% divides the working class and poor people in order to conquer us all. Oppressions don't exist as independent or unattached realities in society, and society as a whole suffers from these oppressions. Now, I'm going to, for this talk, draw upon Marx and Engels' ideas about the origin of women's oppression, which rejected outright the perspective that the low status of women was an unchanging feature of human existence, fixed for all time by human biology or by the ideas in people's heads. Now, Marxism's understanding of history views human beings as not only products of the natural world, but as active agents able to interact with their environments, affecting change within themselves, their social structures, and the natural world around them. This understanding doesn't mesh very well with the flawed perspective that holds women as always being inferior, because it looks at the evidence of the evolution of human history and development. So we got to face facts on a couple of things. Women's oppression is a relatively recent historical development and stems from the rise of class society, the family, and the role of women's unpaid reproductive labor. I'm using recently to reference the past like 10,000 years or so out of the hundreds of thousands of years of human history and development. Women's status in society has always been related to the role that they have played in the family and the various forms that the quote-unquote family has taken in history. The shift towards agricultural production, sharply increased the productivity of labor. This, in turn, increased the demand for labor because the greater number of the field workers meant the higher the yield. Thus, unlike previous hunter-gatherer societies, which sought to limit the number of offspring, agricultural societies sought to maximize women's reproductive potential so the family would have more children to help out with work. Therefore, at the same time that men began playing an increasingly exclusive role in production, women were required to play a much more central and specific role in reproduction. Now, the rigid sexual division of labor remained the same, but production shifted away from the household, and the family was no longer serving anything but a reproductive function. It became an economic unit of consumption for society. Women became trapped within their individual families as the reproducers of society cut off from the means of production. Now, these changes took place first among the property-owning families, the first ruling class, but eventually the nuclear family became a reflective economic unit of society as a whole. Now, there are prevalent arguments, some of y'all might have heard these floating around in academia, like the biological determinist arguments, which would lead us to believe that it is in our human nature for men to be dominant and women to be subordinate. Now, these ideologies lead to beliefs that men are the ones who make history, that they are the subjective factor, while women are merely passive objects to be acted upon. Now, this is a very convenient explanation for a social order that is built upon inequality among a few people at the top and a vast majority at the bottom. You have to think about it. If class divisions can only exist because these divisions are internally fostered at the bottom, it is not that a male worker benefits from the oppression of a female worker, but that capitalists and the 1% benefit from this in a myriad of ways. Lucy Parsons, to give a little shout out, was a labor organizer from right here in Chicago, and I think she put it best. She said, "We, working women, are slaves of slaves. We are exploited more ruthlessly than men, but we must break the twofold yoke." In what became the founding document of feminist theory, The Origin of Family, Private Property, and the State, Ingalls drew upon the work of an anthropologist named Lewis Henry Morgan and came to the conclusion, based on research, that primitive communism, that is a society with more or less egalitarian social relations, accounted for somewhere of 90% of human history. Now, if this is correct, then it has revolutionary implications because it would mean that things like greed and warfare are not rooted in our biology or in individual men. And this means that women's oppression is not something that has to exist. It must therefore be rooted in something else, class society. If women's oppression is rooted in the rise of class society, then what is necessary to achieve women's liberation is the abolition and overthrow of class society. Now, this will lead us into a more specialized focus of the economics of oppression.
In this age of economic crisis and austerity, our government, on the one hand, pays hundreds of billions of dollars to bail out banks and other corporations that created and continue to perpetuate this crisis, while continuing to roll back the gains of the women's rights movement, of course, using the language shared sacrifice. This makes the working class and poor pay for the ruling class's crisis and creates an extraordinary burden on working women, working men, and their offspring. This creates an even more unstable family system. So while capitalism necessitates the nuclear family, it tears out from beneath its feet the very foundation of the family. As a young woman who was born and raised by my single young mother, I witnessed her prosper and succeed in society to an extent, but not without great struggle and the ability to overcome many obstacles, whether financial, social, career-oriented, or otherwise. These obstacles would not have been present had she been part of a privileged group, that of dominance or inherited wealth. As an adolescent, I developed a keen interest in gender issues, and it was only natural for me to build on those interests through education. I have taken women's studies classes at Columbia College here in Chicago, and have since broadened my horizons, cultivating a much more well-rounded understanding of gender oppressions and the roots of such oppressions. I have recently transferred to Northeastern Illinois University to major in justice studies with a minor in women's studies. Through my studies, I've found that women today are still only paid 76 cents for every, and that's 68 cents for African-American women and 58 cents for Latino women to a man's dollar. The Wage Project, Women Are Getting Even, created by a national organization for women, looked exclusively at full-time workers, which estimated that women with a high school diploma could lose as much as $700,000 over a lifetime. Women with a college degree lose $1.2 million, and women professional school graduates lose $2 million. This means college debt is also more burdensome to women than men. The fact that women earn less makes paying for education and paying back student loans a longer and more difficult task and prevents women from paying off debt at the rate that men do, but it doesn't stop there. These inequalities follow women into retirement years, if they even have the ability to retire, and reduces their financial resources such as Social Security benefits, pensions, and savings. This heavy wage gap does not only hurt women, but men as well, making it a tool to instigate lower wages across the board for all workers. During this latest so-called depression, men lost more jobs than women, but during our recession recovery, women have been thrown under the bus because of budget cuts to healthcare and education. Public sector jobs, including teaching and healthcare, are facing intense and detrimental cutbacks, jobs that are predominantly held by women. In education, women made up 76% of teachers in the 2007-2008 school year. The American Federation of Teachers, a labor union, represents 1.5 million members, 73% of whom are female. There is a laundry list of politicians from capitalism's A and B team, also known as Democrats and Republicans, seeking to roll back the clock on working class and poor women. Since taking office in January 2010, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie cut New Jersey school aid by $1.3 billion. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker managed to restrict collective bargaining rights for public employees, including university hospital workers, home health aides, and daycare providers, but not for police or firefighters, both male-dominated fields. Limiting collective bargaining could also jeopardize flexible work hours and maternity leave. In 2011, Republican lawmakers proposed fund cuts for Women, Infants, and Children Nutrition Program, more widely known as WIC. The program provides federal grants to states for food, healthcare referrals, nutrition education for low-income pregnant women, and post-pregnant women with children up to 5 years of age who are found to be at nutritional risk. This program helps protect about 9 million people, low-income women and children. This past year, their budget was cut $504 million. Taking away programs such as this is devastating to poor and working class women and their children who cannot afford proper health care or substantial nutrition. But what tops all of this? After months of work by House Democrats on Obama's Affordable Health Care for America Act of 2010, the floor debate on the bill risks being overshadowed by internal disputes among Democrats over the issue of abortion. In the end, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi decided that abortion opponents should be allowed to offer an amendment that would impose tighter restrictions on abortions that could be offered through a new government-run insurance plan and through private insurance that is bought using government subsidies. Sponsored primarily by Michigan Representative and Democrat Bart Stupak and Nebraska Democrat Senator Ben Nelson, the amendment to legislation passed. What does this now mean? First off, that the Democrats aren't the party that will usher forth women's liberation. But then it explicitly bans abortion coverage from the government-run plan. It also essentially prevents private insurers from selling plans on the National Health Insurance Exchange that cover abortion. So women who intend to use government subsidies for health care costs are forced to switch plans. Additionally, if a woman's employer were to start offering coverage under the National Health Insurance Exchange, she could potentially have to switch plans. There's no public option in the bill. The amendment requires individuals purchasing new plans through state-run exchanges to pay separately for any abortion coverage. This forces insurance plans to drop abortion coverage if they want the massive amount of new business that will come from the individual mandate. There's no such thing as a single-item abortion coverage plan because no one expects to have an unwanted pregnancy. Also, states are allowed to bar individuals from purchasing abortion coverage through the exchange. And just this week, Planned Parenthood suffered another slash in funds. In an alarmingly ironic and disgusting move, the Susan G. Komen for the Cure organization severed ties with Planned Parenthood to eliminate future funding for breast cancer screenings and education. Komen grants to Planned Parenthood totaled $680,000 this past year and $580,000 the previous year. In doing so, the Komen for the Cure, an organization supposedly dedicated to improving and fighting for women's health and safety, has put hundreds of thousands of women's lives at risk, due a huge slap in the face to women who need affordable health services. Do not be fooled by Komen's arguments to back this decision. This was a politically motivated move, as Komen was feeling the pressure from anti-women and anti-abortion lobbyists. When it comes to health care, we have to ask ourselves, in whose interest does this system really serve?
Which brings us expressly to the necessity of abortion rights and bodily autonomy. In order for women to be truly equal and have full participation in society, we need to be in control of our reproductive bodies. Reproductive freedom has been under attack since the inception of the American Medical Association's self-propelled dominance of medicinal practice. Before the Medical Association and in the times of the earliest settlers here, abortion was not only legal, but it was also openly advertised and commonly performed. It wasn't until the late 1800s, when many immigrant families began making their way into the U.S., that states began to pass laws making abortion illegal. Some of these laws were passed based on the fear that too many immigrant children would be born, as their birth rates were higher than that of the white English Protestant women. And so the racist lawmakers devised a restriction to keep women from aborting. As these laws took effect, science and technology advanced, conquering and changing medical practice, thus making surgical procedures safer and more effective. This did not, however, include abortion procedures. Now, this is where the term back alley abortion comes in. New developments and advancements triggered doctors to vie for exclusive rights to practice medicine in order to phase out their competition, midwives, apothecaries, and homeopaths. Once the American Medical Association was established, they deemed abortion immoral and dangerous as a way to stamp out their competitors' most important and frequent procedure while simultaneously seizing control of women's bodies. Women still sought abortions, but at a much higher and more frightening cost. Many of these women died or had severe medical problems as the result of these back alley abortion methods that they were reduced to accept. Taking away a woman's right to an abortion did not reduce the number of women who had them, just based on the number of those who suffered injury and died. Now, moving forward in history, Roe versus Wade gave women the legal choice in 1973. But barely 3 years after that victory, Congress responded with the Hyde Amendment in 1976, which prevents certain federal funds from being used to pay for abortions. This amendment expressly targets women on Medicaid and low-income women, making it extremely difficult to obtain an abortion, even in cases of rape, incest, or if the woman's health is at risk. Every year since then, abortion rights and proper reproductive health care for women in general has been revised, bullied, and manipulated by way of gingerly worded bills and amendments. Right now, and this is actually a really shocking number, 87% of counties in the U.S. do not have any abortion clinics. So not only are abortion rights restricted and services expensive for many, they are absolutely unattainable in areas where clinics are non-existent. So this specifically prevents poor and working class women from accessing much needed health care. After all, abortion is a healthcare issue, and this talk is not going to censor it from, you know, talks of healthcare like the right wing does. So let's take a closer look at a one percenter stance on my bodily autonomy. The Republican creep Rick Santorum, which you can hiss, want to hear a hiss? Yeah. Has pledged to repeal federal funding for contraception, safe sex programs, and other forms of birth control if elected president. This misogynist has used his candidacy platform to primarily victim blame, saying that women should make the best out of a bad situation, referring to rape, and attack poor women's rights to abortion because only his wife, with the support of their family and resources, can handle the procedure. The agenda of the 1% is clear. It's waging war on women's bodies, and in doing so, it's committing itself to a war on the poor. Make no mistake, the same policies that assault women's bodily autonomy and reproductive freedoms also prove to be major blows to the already damaged ways of life for the working class as a whole.
The government of the 1% and its bankster cohorts wage economic warfare on women and their families every day. Every day, poor and working class people are denied quality housing, education, healthy food, clean water, non-toxic air, and health care by our own government. Every day, this results in poor living conditions, which disproportionately affect women. Mm-hmm. This is economic violence. More women face entering into sex work, not of their own volition, but because of their economic circumstances. Society pushes women into this work, but then degrades, devalues, and morally condemns them for it. We are socialized by powerful sources in our world to play the roles prescribed by an inequitable social system. This is the basis of a violent society. If women had the unchallenged ability to control their reproductive means and were compensated for work equally in society, the ruling class would lose its manufacturers of the next generation of poor workers. That is why capitalism has an interest in the continued oppression of women. Capitalism is inherently invested in creating sexist rhetoric to keep women in their place, which leads to the manifestation of sexism and rape culture propagated by the 1%'s media and their need to sell and commodify sex for profit. So are we living under a capitalist rape culture? If rape culture describes a culture in which rape and sexual violence are common and in which prevalent attitudes, norms, practices, and media condone, normalize, excuse, or tolerate sexual violence, I would wager that we're in it. Other examples commonly associated with rape culture include victim blaming, sexual objectification, and trivializing rape. Yeah, sounds like the 1%'s take on things. We can look at two cases in Chicago that highlight not only victim blaming and a failing system, but shed light on how the enforcers of the 1%, the police, play a role in women's oppression. For nearly 2 years, Tijuana Moore has endured the system's failures. First, she was sexually molested by a police officer, and then when she sought justice for this offense, she found herself in the clutches of the state's attorney, mm-hmm. charged with two class one felonies, for eavesdropping, facing up to 15 years in prison. Fortunately, Moore was later acquitted of these ridiculous charges, but had to pay a high price in the process, being harassed and degraded due to her race, social identity, and irrelevant events of her past. Her credibility was under scrutiny, And although she was acquitted, she has yet to receive justice from the original crime committed by our so-called protectors, the police. By the way, this is not an isolated incident. Chicago has finally seen the indictment of two 23rd District officers, Paul Clavijo and Juan Vasquez, on counts of criminal sexual assault and official misconduct. The officers have been charged with raping a 22-year-old woman identified as only Jane Doe in her apartment in Rogers Park after offering her a ride home at 2 a.m. on March 30th, 2011. Both officers have an extensive history of complaints and charges filed against them for acts of sexual violence and harassment. So what can we glean from these examples? The cops are not on our side. They are here to protect the interests of the 1% and in turn are protected by the 1%. They have the courts, the laws, and the resources to get away with rape, murder, and torture. We in the Occupy movement need to voice our disgust at the crimes of police and highlight other cases of police brutality, racism, sexism, and harassment that the police use against the most vulnerable communities in Chicago.
If we take a look at the past year, we see women playing leading roles in the fight for their liberation. Whether it be in Tunisia, Egypt, Wisconsin, or the Occupy movement, the women within these movements are making their own demands. When we look at these struggles and the re-energized fights around women's rights seen with the international slut walks and Walk for Choice, we can see the key to ending women's oppression. The key to ending women's oppression is struggle. A struggle to bring an end to capitalism, to end the subjugation of the many by the few, in favor of the many determining their own courses, both collectively and as individuals. It's a struggle to end the 1%'s domination of our lives. We must remember that sexism is only one of many systematic tools of oppression that is used by the 1% to keep the working class and poor people divided. The 1% wants us to internalize and reproduce this hate. And as people committed to the fight for a better world, we have to be just as diligent in the fight against sexism. We can combat this sexist society in a number of ways through the vehicle of Occupy. We need to constantly reiterate the importance of survivor empowerment and grassroots organizing to fight against instances of systematic sexual violence. We should be standing up for full access and free reproductive healthcare services like contraceptives and abortion. And we should be demanding equal pay for equal work and fighting to have domestic labor recognized and compensated for by the state. We should be challenging the rape culture that's propagated by the media and sponsored by the 1%. And we can help by creating spaces for political education and development within our movement about our history and the struggle for women's liberation. After all, with historical examples ranging from the Russian Revolution of 1917 to the female Black Panthers of the 1960s and 70s, there is so much we can learn from our past movement's gains and losses. And I want to take some time to stress how important organization, agitation, and education are to the fight for women's liberation and to all struggles, as a matter of fact. In order to fully realize our goals and demands for equality and justice, we need to systematically engage with our own history. I want to take some time to point out some particular badass moments in our historical fight for women's liberation, all right, because everybody enjoys these. We're going to go with three big ones. So at the dawn of the political era in 1792, Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley wrote her Vindication of the Rights of Women. This period saw women for the first time in meaningful ways projecting their social consciousness onto society. Wollstonecraft was responding to educational and political theorists of the 18th century who actively believed that women did not need to receive an education. She argued that women ought to have an education commensurate with their position in society, claiming that women were essential to the nation because they educated its children and because they could be companions to their husbands rather than mere wives. Instead of viewing women as ornaments to society or property to be traded in marriage, Wollstonecraft maintained that women are human beings deserving of the same fundamental rights as men. Now, this treaty was incredibly revolutionary for its time, although we'd probably tweak some language. So, moving on, the Paris Commune of 1871. It was a state created by and for the people. Without a standing army or bureaucracy, all officials, including judges, were elected and subject to recall and were all paid workers' wages. The Women's Union of the Paris Commune participated in many municipal commissions, organized cooperative workshops, and formed schools. They demanded gender equality, wage equality, the right of divorce for women, and the right to secular education and professional education for girls. They also demanded suppression of the distinction between married women and concubines. And when Versailles troops were sent to attack and take back the commune's defenses, women were the first to defend the cannons and the commune's schools against the military. They were the first to lead, and in most cases, the first targeted for execution by the military. Moving on to 1917, we saw a mass demonstration of Petrograd women on International Women's Day. Led by a group of striking women textile workers, they marched on the Municipal Duma demanding bread. They called on their husbands and their brothers to join them. 90,000 workers went on strike that day demanding bread and into the war and down with the Tsar and police. Women's International Day is what initiated their February Revolution. Revolutionaries Clara Zetkin, Rosa Luxemburg, and Alexandra Kollontai played critical roles in organizing the German Social Democrats and the Bolsheviks. Now, our women's rights movement has been gutted from corporate-sponsored textbooks. I'm sure many of you, as did I, did not learn about these instances in our developing years in school. We need to inject our history of struggle back into this dehistoricized society, and Occupy is posed to do just this. We need to be even more organized in our reaching out to other groups, trying to realize our same goals, our same demands, and broaden our base towards equity. We need to educate ourselves, continue doing teach-ins and study groups to understand the lessons of the past and glean from them what we can for the here and the now. But equally important is the need to continue to agitate based on our convictions. We should continue to support actions like the one that the Gender Equity Committee held just last weekend in opposition to the anti-woman, anti-queer, anti-poor poor soil conference. I see some folks. Shout out ladies who were there. So it was awesome, and we need to keep empowering our female comrades. Like, this should be a place of empowerment. Occupy should be a place of empowerment for all, but especially for our female-identifying comrades. We need to feel safe. We need to feel respected here, because our fight is your fight, and your fight is our fight. And this wouldn't be a talk on women's and human liberation if we didn't include that old saying, an injury to one is an injury to all. It perfectly encapsulates the nature of Occupy. It's what it's all about. The 99% coming together to demand an alternative to this broken system and make our voices heard. It's solidarity in action. We need to continue to foster this solidarity and promote it within our movement actively. So the question then is, can the oppressed and exploited really end women's oppression? And we will say, by the very existence of struggles of the oppressed and exploited against their own oppression and own exploitation, that the answer is yes. Women's liberation isn't just a chapter in our movement or side work that we do, you know, over here, and then we go over here to our other side work. The fight must be comprehensive, and we need to think of the struggles for gender, race, age, ability, and queer equality as our own struggles. We see these fights, like we see them every day in the work that we're doing around us, but we need to see more clearly the interconnectedness of struggle against oppression and exploitation. There is no making half a revolution. That's it. You want to help take stack?